The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Hugh Muir, and in this month's Global Development Podcast, we'll explore the misconceptions about Africa, how these myths come about, and why they're so damaging to the continent's development. Joining me here in the crucible of debate that is the Guardian coffee shop in East London is an audience and a panel of experts. We have with us Edward Pace, the director of the Africa Research Institute, Sylvie Aboah-Bradwell of the Policy Centre for African Peoples, and Onikachu Wambu from AFFORD, the African Foundation for Development. Welcome to all of you. Now, we'll outline the myths that our audience here and those who've contributed online think are the most damaging to Africa. We'll debate the reality behind them, and we'll try to explain why particular myths are so ruinous to engagement with Africa. And we'll end by discussing how some of these misconceptions arise in the first place. And let's start with one that you, I suppose, you hear most frequently and is in its way the most pernicious. A few people suggested this, James McGlasson, Sammy Parker, and what the thing they'd like us to address is the idea, the notion that Africa is corrupt, or at least that its leaders are corrupt. James McGlasson talked about hearing talk of an all-encompassing corruption. Sammy Parker talked about hearing that the majority of politicians in Africa are corrupt. Now, I know in a way it's strange talking about an entire continent in that kind of stereotypical way, but presumably that's what our panel will want to address. Let me turn first of all to you, Onikachu Wambu. So this is the notion, Africa is corrupt, or at least its leaders are. To what extent, if at all, does that have any credence?
Well, I think the biggest myth about Africa is that you can talk about a continent that can contain China, the United States, most of Western Europe, India, and make these kinds of stupid generalizations.
But you hear them, don't you? You
do. Of course you do, and that is the most pernicious myth about the continent. And half of what is said about Africa is based on ignorance and everything else. There is a problem, however, with corruption, and some of that has to do not with anything that is inherently African. It has to do with the states that we have in Africa and their relationships with ordinary people. And most of those states have been works of fiction that have been created in the last 60, 70 years.
In terms of where the line has been drawn on the map.
And where the lines have been drawn. If you look at African communities that are organic and coherent and some of the village level communities, you don't have the degree of corruption that we see, because those states or those structures are organic. People have worked out over the years ways of achieving accountability, transparency, and all these issues. There is a problem, and a specific problem, with these new constructions that happened as a result of the colonial period and the relationship that people have with the people who run those states. And others have talked very lucidly about what happens when you try and select people in those kind of multi-ethnic, multi-national states that are not real.
Sylvie, you do hear this an accusation levelled. Mm-hmm. How unfair is it? Because there's corruption everywhere, but Africa seems to get it in the neck.
Look, the fact that we are here to debunk myths doesn't mean that we just have to try and debunk them for the sake of trying. The same way that we have Archbishop to refer to a superior type of bishop, we have to use harsh corruption when it comes to African leaders. That's how bad it is. However, that doesn't mean that this is due to the fact that Africans have an extra corruption genes in comparison with other human beings. It is simply due to the fact that African states were created on a fundamentally corrupt principle, whereby power was handed by the former colonizers, not to the people who were the most principled, the most eager to serve their people, but the most corrupt, who will rob, kill, and slaughter their people to stay in power. And the fact that people here in the West are not aware of this reality is due to the blame myth which is that everybody here knows that you cannot understand what is the UK today without referring to something that happened nearly 1,000 years ago called the Norman Conquest. But whenever one tries to explain the reality of Africa by explaining and referring to the colonial facts that happen within living memory, they tell you it is the blame game. No, it's just how things are.
Edward Pace, when you hear this said, does it say more about us and our misunderstanding of history than it says about the continent itself?
Absolutely, I would say that's true. I'd like to make a general comment about the myths. The problem with myths is that they're binary, and you know, reality is far more complex, myths are powerful. Most of these ones that we're debating tonight are, in their own way, fairly ruinous and unhelpful. On this particular one, I mean, of course, there are some corrupt leaders and there are plenty who are not. It's just the same as everywhere. If we look at the situation in Ukraine at the moment, does that mean that the whole of Central Europe gets categorised in the same way? Well, it shouldn't. One point I'd like to raise that hasn't been mentioned perhaps explicitly by the others yet is the extent to which international business, donors and everybody else have exacerbated corruption on the continent in many respects. We see this in resource extraction, for example. You know, that African Development Bank recent report, $1 trillion of illicit financial flows out of the continent over the last 30 years. So, these are things we have to think about seriously. Corruption exists everywhere in the world, but it thrives where you create conditions in which it can thrive. And I would say that international actors have, played a significant role in that.
Edward, I agree with you, but I think the international actors are a symptom of what Sylvia and myself are talking about. The fact is that if the African people are not able to hold their leaders to account, then leaders will behave in any way that they want. And there is no doubt.
It's true everywhere.
Yeah, as it's true everywhere. And so the point is, how can we create a politics in Africa where there's accountability to the ordinary Africans? And these states have not been able to do that.
And so there's two things. There's the stimuli for any corruption that there is, and then there's the whether or not people choose to react to that stimuli in a corrupt way.
It's not so much that whether or not people choose to react. Are people in a position to react to that? The situation is this. In Africa, most leaders are unaccountable because they rely on foreign aid, and foreign aid allows them to do whatever they want. This is the basic problem, that the corrupt system that was put in the 1960s is still there because we are not allowing African populations to have a proper, healthy relationship with the leaders, full stop.
Okay, let's go to our audience and get their view on this particular canard, if you like, that Africa is corrupt, or at least its leaders are. And would anyone like to make a point on that? The lady here.
I think within all facets of countries where there is extreme poverty, and a lot of African countries are facing extreme poverty, there is corruption. If you go to places in South London, you can't walk past a pub without, doing some kind of, it might not be financial, but without kind of giving yourself up in some way. I've been to Russia and you have to give money. Anywhere there is such extreme poverty, people feel the system is not giving them ways to earn a living. They find other ways, and that's where corruption comes from. Even in America, not in the airport maybe, but you go to parts of Brooklyn and it's clearly documented that sections of society can't walk past the street.
Sylvia, you want to come in there quickly?
Yes, please. Let me clarify something. We are not here to engage in Africa bashing. We are here because we care about the African continent and we care about African peoples. We want progress. And if we don't identify the problem, we will never solve it. I am telling you, what is going on in most African countries, it's dreadful. And the situation is this. The corruption of the society started hundreds of years ago with slavery. And you cannot compare what is happening in Africa with other countries because our circumstances are special, specific. We have had 4 centuries of slavery, of being destroyed, and the same thing with the colonization. So we have to rethink the way we address the problems. We cannot afford the luxury of comparing ourselves with the worst and striving for the worst. Not at all. We have to strive for excellence. Africans have been at a stage in their history where they were giving lessons to the world. When Europe was talking about the Dark Ages, Africa was thriving. It was the brilliant continent with universities and so on and so on. We have to go back to that point. But we won't do it if we compare ourselves with the worst in the world. Not at all.
Okay, let me stop you there because we have to move on. Let's look at another issue that people who've sent in a contribution would like us to address. And it's the idea that human rights don't matter in Africa. And you hear that manifested most often as regards the issue of sexual equality. We know that homosexuality is illegal in 37 countries, punishable by death in some states. In Uganda, of course, there's new legislation that broadens the scope of what can happen in terms of offences. You can get life imprisonment for certain offences there. So that seems to feed into this idea that human rights aren't observed generally across the continent. Let's deal with that one. Edward Pace.
Whose human rights? The whole human rights dialogue has been caught up in politics very strongly, particularly recently, and particularly over the issue of homophobia. I mean, I, of course, utterly reject the suggestion that people in Africa don't have, their own concepts of human rights. But whose are they? What I have some problem with is governments and individuals being told exactly the way they should think about everything. And it is that issue that certain presidents are using at the moment to shore up their own domestic political situations by kicking back against it. And I think this is an intractable problem because, you know, clearly one isn't seeking to see the oppression of any group at all. But its capture, the issue of human rights within the political sphere, is making it very difficult at the moment to have realistic, you know, to gain traction and to achieve the objectives that, you know, people would like to see achieved. And I think that's very difficult, and it's upsetting and dangerous for those who are on the wrong end of what is going on.
Yeah. I want to catch you, Wambu, address this one. When someone approaches you at a party and says, well, Africa, in most of it, human rights don't really matter. What do you say?
Well, over the last 400 years, the people who have helped define human rights have been Africans as a result of enslavement. All the rights that we have been Africans in the diaspora elsewhere who have expanded those rights. The gay liberation movement starts after the civil rights movement because and people like James Baldwin and others are at the forefront of defining this space. So, in terms of taking lectures about human rights, I don't think Africans need to do that. There is something interesting that is happening in Africa around some of these issues, and it's not what we think it is. What is happening is that as much as Africans have helped expand and move human rights forward, there are also others who are in reaction to that. There are other conservative forces. There are other things that are happening inside of different societies. And those are the things that we need to be understanding if we want to support progressive politics in Africa about how to bring about the changes that we want to see and the reform that we want to see. One of those things that is happening is that with globalization, people are feeling anxious at the pace of change. It is interesting that the pushback is both a function, as Edward said, of some politicians using that, but it's also a function of this moment of African rising, where there is incredible transformation and movement going on the continent, and people are feeling anxious about that. There is also, obviously, the rise of religious fundamentalism, whether Islamic or Christian. We've seen that globally. That, again, is a function of this globalization moment, and that is having its own particular take in Africa. And it's not just the gay people who are under attack. A lot of minorities in Africa are under attack. In the north of Nigeria, people are being blown up in churches and blown out and massacred in schools. There is something that is going on around the issue of kind of majority rights, minority rights. Elsewhere, it's albinos who are being attacked. So this is not a function of just a kind of a homophobia. I know people in the West want to frame it in that way, and it's a very kind of simplistic argument. There are huge movements, and we need to be on the side of progressive politics, but in order to do that, we need to understand what is happening and how best to challenge this.
Sylvia, it has to be addressed, doesn't it? Because many countries will want to engage with the West on all sorts of levels, and it makes it very difficult if the West has that perception.
Now, you are absolutely right that we need to address it, but in order to be able to address it successfully, we need to understand where it is coming from. The fact is, Africans are no less or more homophobic than other people. What has happened is that before the arrival of the colonizers, they had a way of expressing their homophobia, which is to pretend that there was no homosexuality. That's why in most African languages you won't find a word for homosexuality. They didn't want to dignify that with a name. What colonization did then was to enable Africans to articulate and systematize their refusal to accept homosexuality. The advantage of having been, like me, a teenager with spectacles and obsessed with books in Cameroon is that you come across all type of things. And I came across an old draft of the Cameroonian constitution, whereby it said something like, burglary is illegal, be it indoors or outdoors, on grass or on snow. That shows clearly that they copied that verbatim from the French and English colonizers. They didn't know snow. However, may I just say something quickly?
Very quickly.
What is happening now, the reactionary against homosexuality in countries like Uganda and Nigeria, it's not due to African impetus. There are evangelists coming from the United States and the West and pushing, and we have Islamic fundamentalists coming from the Middle East. The way forward is not for the West to push strenuously, because it gives leeway to the people like Museveni, who are going to frame it into a cultural confrontation between West and Africa, which is not at all. The way forward is for enlightened Africans to say, we have suffered discriminations for centuries. We cannot afford to engage into discrimination, not least because it is African populations that are suffering, and we are giving opportunities to anybody to politicize the debate.
Can I just take a contribution from the audience? What do you feel about this particular issue, and whether or not this is it a fair criticism that there is homophobia throughout the African countries, and what to be done? How should they address that?
I think mine is to ask, this is a simple question. Are we expecting so much of Africa, which got the independence just a few years ago? Are we expecting so much? The countries of Africa have been colonized for all those years, and what they are perpetuating is, as they say, as they put it, has been inherited from the colonial masters, who are now, you know, telling some of our countries that if you choose a certain kind of leader, there are consequences.
But wherever it comes from, the countries not have to deal with the world as it is. Whatever the origins of it, the world is as it is now, and the stance taken by a number of countries makes it very difficult for them to play a part in the world community. So I want to bring in an audience member there, Yusa.
I just want to say, you know, I think for some of us, I'm Zimbabwean, for instance, the tragedy is the way in which homosexuality and the way homophobia is treated becomes a moral panic, a sort of agenda setting of certain institutions and countries. I don't think, for instance, if I look at the way I've grown up in Zimbabwe, using homosexuality and homophobia as the paragon of the respect for human rights is in itself adequate, because there are a multitude of problems that Zimbabweans have faced for the past decade. And I don't think we should establish a hierarchy of rights where at a certain moment, certain forms of rights become primary. I think it also becomes problematic, especially when an understanding of human rights or sexuality is couched in a very ethnocentric way, where the expectation is that people only become respectful of human rights if they fit in a particular standard that's been defined by others. I think if you look, for instance, studies that have been done by people like Mark Ebrecht in Zimbabwe, in terms of the expressions of people's sexuality, homophobia becomes an invented category, actually. Because when we say homosexuality and we use it from a particular context and impose it on another context, we ignore traditionally established ways of expressing sexuality. So I think the starting point becomes problematic. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. I'm going to move on now because the clock is perpetually against us. And we want to explore another myth or misconception about Africa, perhaps. And it's the idea that Africans are always in poverty. And I suppose juxtaposed with that is a sense that Africa can't do capitalism. And so that what one will almost cause the other. Edward Pace.
Oh, golly, I don't even know where to begin on this one. I mean, this is just so left field. Poverty. I mean, you know, at Africa Research Institute, we're just working with partners who, you know, every day are showing that this is nonsense. And that's my experience, you know, right throughout the continent. I mean, whether it's someone rewriting a constitution or whether it's someone setting up a nursing and midwifery institution. So this idea of helplessness is just complete nonsense. Poverty, well, there is a point to be made here. I mean, of course, it's not perpetual. It's never perpetual anywhere. And if you look at Brazil, for example, now a program like the Bolsa Família lifted 30 million Brazilians out of poverty in a single generation. Now, I'm not saying that's ideal or that it's a model, but let's just dispel this idea that anything is permanent in this respect. One thing that is true is that the really encouraging economic growth in many countries on the continent over the last decade is in most of them not translating into poverty reduction. And this is not a criticism, it's an issue that is being addressed by African Development Bank, by the AU, by UNECA. You know, we have got to look at ways in which economic growth, A, can be sustained, and B, can feed into more rapid reduction in poverty rates. I mean, at the moment, those economies with the fastest growing economies, you know, also, for example, have the highest rates of youth unemployment on the continent. I mean, that's come out of a recent UNECA study. So poverty is not permanent, but there is a really important work to be done here by everyone, by, you know, businesses, by think tanks, by individuals, to ensure that maximum advantage is taken of the really commendable economic performance in so many countries.
Sylvia Anoni, attack this for me from the other direction, in that everyone talks about poverty in Africa. Talk to me a little about wealth in Africa, because a lot of people assume that there isn't much.
Well, what I was going to say is, on the point of doing capitalism, you can't do capitalism without capital. Yeah? And the point of about colonialism was that it did three things. It defeated Africa militarily. It created lots of social things about where you can live and kind of monitoring relationships between people. And the third thing was that it dominated capital. At independence in Nigeria by 1970, you have a situation where all the companies, top companies in Nigeria, are owned by the British. So how do the Nigerians get capital to own their own economy? One solution they came up with, which goes back to the issue of corruption, was that they looted the state to get this in capital, so that 30, 40 years later, you look at the top companies in Nigeria and they're now owned by all the looters. But at least they're Nigerian, they're no longer British. A very interesting thing happened was that in the time that they were looting initially, the money went outside in Switzerland, everywhere else. And then in the early 90s, as part of this African rising strategy or narrative, you could actually get a better return on capital in Nigeria. So the money's been flooding back. And a lot of the activity you're seeing in Lagos is that capital coming back.
But so, even now, when people talk to me or I hear conversations about great wealth and there are television programs across Africa about how, you know, the rich and famous and what marvelous houses they have and marvelous lives they have, people still are very surprised about that.
Exactly. Please, do not believe that Onyekachi and me are obsessed with history. It's just that we have an understanding of what's going on, and we are so passionate about changing the reality. So, nice Guardian readers as you are, I am going to say something that will shock you utterly, that this image of poverty in Africa started centuries ago. It is something that, the same way that it was justified to say it's better for an African to be enslaved than to be free in savagery, it's the same thinking that allowed colonization to say that they can't rule themselves, when we know that Africans have been ruling themselves for centuries, for millennia. So when we come to the perception of the poor African who needs help, who need aid, who is constantly dependent, it's the same thing. The sooner you guys understand that the poverty and misery or wealth of Africa is none of your business, the better for everybody. Number one, maybe you are going to have to restrict me physically on this one.
I may have to do that.
So number one, it prevents the West from engaging with Africa in a better and more positive way. And that's why the Chinese, who just see development opportunities, go there and outclass all the Westerners who have been dealing with Africa forever. Number two, it creates such a dependency that Africans cannot even hold their leaders into account. Let me ask you a question.
Very quickly,
if,
please.
If Save the Children had been giving breads to the French, do you think that the French Revolution will have taken place? It wouldn't, because there are forces that need structural and political and social changes, and it cannot happen whenever there are images of poor Africans and the Guardian readers rushing to give money. It's none of your business. You mustn't give any money, because China is poor, but the Chinese are using their poverty as an asset. They say, come and invest. What do Africans do? Please come and build hospitals for us. It's disgraceful. It's a nasty business that has to stop.
Okay, well, you've answered two questions there, because you've moved us smoothly into what was going to be our next point, which was about aid and whether or not aid has actually helped Africans. That you will hear the opinion, and you've heard it quite strongly there, that aid actually is more of a hindrance than a help. Onyekachi Nwambu.
I agree with a lot of what Sylvia said, but I would nuance it. I think where aid has been useful is where there's a humanitarian crisis and people go in, and that is very useful. I don't think aid has very much of an idea about doing development. Emergency relief, humanitarian response, and fine, development, I think lots of mistakes have been made. I'll give you an example. There's a difference between when we talk about development, we talk about the South or Africa generally, and when we talk about development in the North, we talk regeneration. What's the difference? In the North, when you do regeneration, Ken wants to regenerate the East End, so he comes up with the Olympics. You bring in everybody, the national government, chambers of commerce, private enterprise, everybody, and there's a big effort. You create probably 10,000 jobs and reclaim an area that has been destroyed for the last 50 years. In Africa, you want to do regeneration in a village, you send a goat to a woman. This is not serious. We need to be talking about the kinds of structural transformation that has happened in China, and that has to do with African leaders understanding what they need to do. It has to do with putting in place important things like laying down infrastructure, bringing the private sector into the picture. Most aid agencies, and I have had conversations with people, don't want to deal with the private sector. How are you going to reform? That's only just beginning, the discourse about how you involve the private sector. How are you going to change a country without I mean, who's going to employ these people without jobs? Who's going to create that? The whole thing is so bizarre.
Some people say the problem of it, the concept of aid is difficult. Some people say actually it's the way we do it or the way it's done that's the problem. Which is it?
I think I would say that the way it's delivered is seriously problematic. I mean, it's there's competing agendas. You know, you go to a country that's just come out of a war situation where arguably there is a humanitarian imperative, to pick up on what Onyekachi said, and actually the thing is completely uncoordinated, and this then can exacerbate problems. So I think there, and even in non-post-conflict, perfectly peaceful countries, I think there are real serious difficulties of coordination and delivery. And one of the biggest problems on aid is that most of the donors won't actually subscribe to the rules they've agreed for themselves. I mean, if the Paris declarations, for example, were actually observed, it would be done better. I'm not saying it's either ideal or, and I'm the issue of whether I've seen plenty of places where aid has been extremely helpful and very effective and saved lives, but the way it's delivered, the way it is so often disjointed, not coordinated, and the way it doesn't observe building, again to pick up on your catch is saying about if you don't have a functioning government, aid can't replace it. It cannot replace it. And this is a real problem with its results.
So we seem to have oversimplified a lot of this, and that's where these misconceptions seem to come from. I'm going to come back to you. We're coming towards the end. I'll come back to our panel. I want to get a sense from you. We hear all these myths. I'd like to know what you think is the big thing that's going to surprise us about Africa in the next 12 months. I'll ask you that in a moment. But I want to come to our audience first of all, and just to explore for just a short while where these myths come from and how damaging you think they are.
Yeah, no, I think, and TV advertising and the charities advertising, and you've got WaterAid and constantly, and it annoys the hell out of me. It's constantly, this child needs water and this child is dying. Not the story and things, and definitely in the past 5-10 years since the Millennium Development Goals and what has been achieved, that story is not being told. Also the story of African people wanting to help themselves, and when you go there and when you meet with them, they're not just sitting around doing nothing. They want to help themselves. You give them the opportunity, you teach them something, they want to be helping themselves. And that's not communicated via media, but via charity advertising, although some charities have changed. You see the Oxfam ad recently, with the child floating. Things are slightly changing, but, there's still too many charities.
Yeah, I was going to say a very sort of damaging aspect. And again, when we're talking about aid, how we're probably all seeing it and thinking about the white saviour, which has been a massively perpetuated concept, which is, to some extent, it's ridiculous. Not to some extent, it is ridiculous. I mean, we talk about aid, we talk about development, we talk about charities. There are experts across the continent. There are African charities across the continent doing incredible work. Every charity needs money. All UK-based charities, they fundraise within the continent.
So is that Sylvie's argument that we'd construct these myths the better to justify Western intervention?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I think Sylvie raised one of the really good points she raised was with each of these myths to look behind where they come from and who's invented them. I'm surprised that all of these myths are fundamentally negative. I wish we'd had some of the really over-exuberant ones fed in as well, because it's more closely aligned to the Africa Rising narrative, and one can see what elements of truth there are or not. All of these are very... they're very negative.
Well, we can do that. Do that, because I want to just come to the last point. We're going to have to wrap up, but I'll start with you then. What's the one big thing that's going to surprise us about Africa in the next 12 months? And maybe it will be a good thing.
The issue of the white saviour complex is it's an interesting one, and it's a dangerous one. Talking to somebody about the gay issue in Africa, who was one of the conservative forces, and I was seeking to understand what their perspective was, his take on this was, look, 100 years ago, they came in, eyes blazing, the intensity, and told us what we were doing was wrong. And that, this is the way to do it. You discriminate against homosexuals. And now they're telling us, 100 years later, that what we're doing is wrong. In another 100 years' time, will they tell us that the current position is wrong? And why should we be listening to people who can be wrong in 100 years, so profoundly wrong? And that is an interesting argument to listen to. And so what is interesting is that the solutions need to come from inside, and less reliance on mythologies that are created outside and people who come in with the same kind of burning intensity each time.
Will that happen? Do you see that happening?
The solutions are coming from inside, and I think there are two game changers to end. One is that we talked, for me, this is about money and economics, and it's about jobs. All this other stuff is, you know, fantasy. We go back to the key things. All of us who go to school here, we want a job at the end. And if your aid is not doing jobs, I don't know what it's doing. You're going there prattling about, as far as I'm concerned. So it's about economics. How do you create an infrastructure that's going to work? And I think that there are two key things that have given movement in Africa that are going to move things forward, and which I just hope that those things can become self-sustaining. One is that there's a lot of capital going into Africa, and particularly from the diaspora, and that is going to be quite a big game changer. 60 billion went in last year from Africans outside. When China was at a critical point of its takeoff, it was the Chinese diaspora who provided that before the West and everybody else came in the 80s. And I think this is going to be what we need, is money and capital to invest in the things that matter, and the Chinese are investing. So the diaspora and the Chinese in huge numbers. And then the other thing is that Africans are now communicating with each other. The mobile phone is going to be a very powerful way for us to begin to communicate, which has been something, and the new technologies, which is something that we haven't had. We've had to listen to The Guardian and others and get our news from the BBC, and that is not happening any longer. Okay. Now there's an internal conversation, and I think that is going to lead to the kind of, I think, exciting, internally driven development that we need,
okay,
that
so
will
we
produce jobs.
We've heard all the myths. Tell us something that's true and maybe something that's positive.
Yes, something positive that I wish people were aware of more is that we have two wonderful countries in Africa, Botswana and Mauritius. People don't know that, but actually the per capita income of Botswana and Mauritius is like nearly twice as big as that of China. So the average person in Botswana and Mauritius is nearly twice as rich as the average person in China, and yet nobody talks about that. However, what the problem I have is that we don't usually understand where things come from in relation to Africa. Mauritius and Botswana are better, not because the people of these countries are more intelligent than other Africans, but simply because they have had democratic, self-governing government that have been serving the people. I wish the aid industry will become less parasitical in terms of promoting Africa's poverty to diminish, and Africans too should become less dependent instead of relying on the French to put away wars in the Central African Republics or on the Chinese to build headquarters in Addis Ababa. What a shame.
Okay, I'll let you get one last swipe in there. Edwin, I'm going to end with you.
I'll be very quick because I know we're ending. I think Africa this year will continue to surprise on the upside. I would agree with Onyekachi entirely on that front. There will be things that go wrong, and as there are in any continent, but you know, there is a great deal that is extremely encouraging and progressive, and technology I would certainly highlight as being, if not a game, let's not call it a magic bullet, because I'm always very nervous of that sort of thing, but there are a great many games being changed by technology, and having just come back from Nairobi, you know, there is perhaps no city on the continent where one can see that so quickly and evidently. I'm not saying that they're necessarily, you know, unchallenged leaders, but you just see it everywhere there. And we're looking at, you know, life-changing applications in medicine. I mean, now, you know, tutorials are being delivered down the internet from King's College Hospital to Somaliland, etc. You're seeing this sort of technology taking off and being incubated on the continent, and I think that's fantastically encouraging.
Edward, this is what we call sending them home happy, so thank you very much for that. But that really is all we have time for. My thanks to Edward Pace, to Sylvie Eboah-Radwell and Oni Kachiwambu, and of course to my audience here at Guardian Coffee for all of their questions and their contributions. But for now, thank you for listening. I'm Hugh Muir, the producer of this podcast was Ian Chambers, and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.